Alright, so here we are again at 8.5 recording the next episode of the podcast.
And we do not know what to talk about.
Yeah, I think that's the general theme of our lives these days. We really don't know what's going on. It's just like every day is like a jam session. We have some idea about what to do throughout the day, and then the rest of the day turns out to be
MDP,
yeah.
Yeah.
Chetan just sends me an emoji, like I think he has one standard emoji saved at the top of his list at like 2 PM every day and 11 PM every day. I just get that emoji. There's no other text exchange.
Coffee.
Just that emoji with a question mark.
No, I used to write coffee, ya chai, anything, but then at some point you start getting more lazy. And so emoji suffices. But let's see, Santosh. Today I was at the main building for some reason. And the general discussion there was that Santosh has been with his guide for like 4 hours and discussing God knows what. So, I mean, what was that discussion or anything that's related to your work that you're doing? Everyone wants to know about something about
conditioning. Yeah, I just know that there is some weird algebra somewhere, some commutators flying around and there's some spin chain, something I don't understand basically. What's your system? What are you simulating?
You see, as for today's meeting, don't ask me about it. It is basically about Sriji telling me that I have a very bad chance of getting a PhD compared to Rishikesh and Kolhatkar as usual.
Why are you? Don't please, man. I was in a good mood until now.
Okay, so what I'm working on for my fifth year is something called... It's a spin chain.
What's a spin chain?
So, how do I put it? Everyone is familiar with the Ising model. It is basically there are spin up, spin down, and then I connect them via links. And based upon these links, we can, of course, and then there is a very interesting property of the Ising model, which says that in one dimension, as usual, there is no phase transition. In two dimensional, there is this famous Onsager solution, which proves that, Onsager was the first person who solved the two-dimensional Ising model exactly, and he proved that there is a phase transition. And then it is, from what I remember, the Ising model in three dimensions is dual to the liquid-gas transition in some way. That is still an open problem in physics.
People are trying to bootstrap it. I know a lot of high-energy people working on bootstrapping of 3D Ising model, Richkov and these people, but let's not talk about Richkov.
Also, for people in high energy, there is something called the Ising CFT, which I keep hearing about. I'm not really sure.
I guess the broad point is something related to statistical mechanics, which is that the reason statistical mechanics works at all is something known as universality. So the thing is that if you look at a system macroscopically, you realize that the microscopic details of the system are more or less irrelevant at larger scales, and so it doesn't matter what kind of microscopic dynamics the system has. On a macroscopic scale, the dynamics is kind of universal.
This is just a very generic EFT kind of picture.
Yeah, so
at a low energy, you have some symmetries that describe your theory, and it doesn't matter what the high energy physics it derives from.
Right. So the renormalization group, or I would say, quantum field theory gives you a good picture to understand all these things in a very systematic way. And so the idea is that a lot of various seemingly very different quantum systems or quantum field theories seem to have a similar kind of a universality class. And for some very interesting systems, the universality class is the same as that for the 3D Ising model. Mm. And so that's one reason why high energy people are quite interested in solving this radiating. So yeah, you can take
spin chain. What are these links you were talking about? Just basically interactions, right?
Yeah, just nearest neighbor interactions. So I'll just summarize the 2D Ising model very quickly. And the basic idea is this: it can only be solved with zero magnetic field. People have solved it like for infinitesimal magnetic fields, but that's beyond the thing. For zero magnetic field, this is how you do it. You have a two-dimensional classical Ising model. I map it to a one-dimensional quantum mechanical model at zero temperature. This one-dimensional quantum mechanical model, it is called the transverse field Ising model. It is very well studied. And the way you solve this transverse field Ising model in one dimension is you convert it to a theory of fermions. More precisely, you convert it to a theory of free fermions. You'll end up with superconducting terms somewhere. and then you implement something called a Bogoliubov transformation, and yeah, you can boom bomb it out.
Why are you using the football coach lingo here? But okay,
no. I don't even know where the word boom bomb
came from. Boom bomb came from Coach Salim, Coach Pathan, the legend. And then I think Rohan and I use it a lot in conversation, so you've picked it up from there.
Yes. So yeah, you map it to this one-dimensional system. This one-dimensional system can be exactly solved, and that's the story there. What I am studying is a generalization of this transverse field Ising chain. The transverse field Ising chain is... I don't want to write a mathematical expression for it. Okay, so basically, you have nearest neighbor interactions and a magnetic field term. Now, the generalization I am studying is, usually in a transverse field Ising chain, there is a two-dimensional Hilbert space at each point, at each lattice site. What I am studying is a generalization in the way that there is an n-dimensional Hilbert space at each lattice site. But the catch is this. The version I am studying is non-Hermitian. So what we realize is that the two-dimensional case at each point is special in the case that the polymatrices which are used to describe this, the polymatrices are Hermitian. But when I extend it to beyond two, the generalization of the polymatrices, let us call them sigma and tau, for example. Say tau is a generalization of sigma x and sigma is a generalization of sigma z. Now, these are not Hermitian. They obey the algebra that for the n-dimensional case, sigma and tau raised to the power n minus 1 will be equal to sigma dagger and tau dagger respectively. And the interesting part is the algebra between them is sigma tau is equal to omega tau sigma, where omega is the nth root of unity. Now, when I introduce the nearest neighbor term looks like sigma j dagger sigma j plus 1. You can immediately see that it is not Hermitian all in itself, and I have to add a Hermitian conjugate. The problem is this. If I do add a Hermitian conjugate, I get a theory of interacting parafermions. I still haven't said what parafermions are, but later we'll get to that. I get a theory of interacting particles via the same Jordan-Wigner transformation. But now suppose I omit the Hermitian conjugate. If I omit the Hermitian conjugate, what has been recently proved is that this is dual to a theory of free parafermions. And what do we mean by free here is basically this. States are labeled entirely by their occupation numbers in some way. The way this works, and the crucial point in what I'm working on, is that this has been proved only in open boundary conditions. Adding a periodic boundary term or a twisted boundary term, it just ruins the entire thing. And what is even more important is that this model is integrable. So it has a set of conserved charges, all of which commute among each other. And
brief question. You said we treat this as a free theory in the sense that the states are labeled just by their occupation numbers.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that? Like, so you have a two-particle state in your theory, and you have a two-particle state in some, interacting theory. Is a two-particle state well-defined in an interacting theory, though? I don't think it is. I think you only have momentum labels.
Yeah, so I think at least in the quantum field theoretic sense, we know that interacting theories can, like, we cannot have this ladder operator kind of description for interacting theories. That's why we have this S-matrix formalism where we think of the theory asymptotically and then we sort of consider the interaction as perturbation about the...
Yeah, that's why you do everything with interaction field pictures, which basically are free fields.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, in that... But I have some questions. So, Santosh, you said this system has a lot of conserved charges which commute with each other.
Yes.
Shouldn't they be like in some sort of involution, some algebra? They generally don't they just follow some algebra, because just commuting with each other, like, that's a very special case of a system being integrable, right?
The general, I think, working definition of integrability is that you can write a transfer matrix. This transfer matrix is usually a function of some parameter, and let us call this T of U, and T of U commutes with T of V for all U and V. And now what I can do is, since this commutes, I can immediately say that T of U commutes with the first derivative of U and its successive derivatives. And now suppose I specialize to a specific value of U, let us say 1 or 0.
Now I'll say that t of 0 commutes with the derivative of t at 0. I'll commute double derivative at 0 and so on. This gives an entire hierarchy.
So I think it's like this. So you have some symmetry operators.
Mm-hmm.
And the symmetry operators, like you said, have an algebra. They generate some algebra. Like the symmetry generates some algebra. Like algebra of translations is generated by the momentum operators, which have some symmetry relations.
Mm-hmm.
So he's probably looking at something like an abelian algebra, like the generators, the algebra of the generators is abelian,
right? So
basically,
I mean,
translation,
it's real. Yeah,
that's
real.
Sort of what I was getting at, because see, like this idea that you're if you look at a simpler example, say I wanted to say harmonic oscillator, but let's just say a hydrogen atom. We know that we can label the states by certain operators that commute with each other, like Jz and Hamiltonian and stuff, but you can define more generators which do not commute with each other, but you realize that they form an algebra amongst themselves. And so, I mean, having certain generators that commute with each other, so that's what I was saying, that probably the generators commuting with each other is like a special case of the system being integrable, because you can have like basically you can have these generators which can commute among each other and sort of form an algebra.
I think maybe a group theoretic way to look at it is you're looking at the center of some larger group.
Yeah.
You're looking at the center of some larger group, so these generators commute with, you know, among themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
if I want to give it a algebraic structure.
Yeah, and the remaining algebraic structure is basically like the co-cycle structure.
Hmm.
So the quantums, the good quantum numbers, the quantum numbers that label your states are, they belong to the center of some larger subalgebra. Like they belong to the center of some larger algebra,
right?
And everything else is just, you know, an extended co-cycle or something. Because, you know, when he mentioned, for example, that sigma and tau have commutation relations, like sigma comma tau is a dagger or something.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot like a co-cycle, right? This is like a, you know, the center. This is a one co-cycle. Like you're extending the center by some commutator. So let's say you had some translation generators. They commute with each other, they form like an algebra. You have some generators of momentum, they commute with each other. But then you can add like a position and momentum translation commutator. Make it proportional to another generator that's basically IH bar in quantum mechanics. But it's kind of like the same thing here. Here it's a dagger or something.
Right.
But it's just another operator. So
but,
it's like a one
so cosec. What I sort of felt from that was that it seemed like something that describes an anion, right? Because it was sigma and tau commutator with each other gives some complex number times tau.
No,
sigma.
No. It was sigma times tau is simply a root of unity times tau.
Right,
sigma.
So it's some complex number times. Like usually in case of fermions, it's minus.
It's
and
minus.
Bosons, it's just commuting objects. So in this case, it was some complex number, which usually refers to some anion. So why? What is this anion structure? Do you have any idea why? Or let me ask another question. You said this omega was some root of unity, right? So suppose I take the sixth root of unity. Would it somehow correspond to a SO6 spin chain or something? Or what is a SON spin chain? Can you describe? Do you have any idea? Because it seems
an SO6 spin chain.
SON spin chain.
SON spin chain. Do you know what that is? Because I have seen this term somewhere in a very different context.
I have never seen the generalization. Okay, the Heisenberg, for example, is an SU2 spin chain. It has the SU2 symmetry. But I'm pretty sure it's not that hard to construct SON spin chains or whatever, but I really don't know much about this. And this is the point, right? In what I'm talking about are this hierarchy of conserved charges. I do not know what symmetry they correspond to.
It's usually an infinite dimensional symmetry, right? So it's not always very obvious what that symmetry should be. So usually what I've seen in the integrability literature is they talk about something known as a Yangian. So you take these all these charges which are in involution. It's something like this. You have a ladder operator kind of structure.
Mm-hmm.
So you take two generators, and if they are some sort of ladder operators, you know that it will lead to something else. So it will raise the level of the state or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you can construct something like you can take certain generators out of this, all the generators in involution that you have, and taking the commutator or whatever the generalization in this case is, or the Poisson bracket, some kind of a bracket. Of these two will together give you another generator, but this generator will be of a higher rank or something. And so you can keep on constructing like this ladder operator kind of series. And all of them will be, it will be some infinite dimensional algebra.
Yeah.
It's usually very like rare that you have a very like well-defined algebra that even if it's infinite dimensional.
that is because the raising and lowering operators in the system I'm studying, okay, naively would expect, let us say something like for the n-dimensional Hilbert space at each point, we would naively expect that whatever creation annihilation operators I write down for these anions or parafermions, they would naively go as a par n is equal to 0. But it's not. But it's really not. It goes as a par n is something which behaves like the identity. I don't want to say identity exactly because it is actually a projection operator on that space. So basically I add like n particles to it and it comes back to the initial state. It doesn't annihilate the state completely. That is the thing. And the problem is this, the way this was mapped to the free theory is actually very interesting because it's a very smart solution if you ask me. The way the solution was written was this. Solving for H is actually a very hard problem. Nobody has ever solved the eigen problem for H. But the way that you work is this. I don't look at H, but I look at the behavior of commutator of H with an arbitrary operator. Mm-hmm. And now it so turns out that I can find a set of creation annihilation operators.
Okay.
Now, since I can find a set of exact creation annihilation, Now I find a finite set of creation annihilation operators and say that the commutator of H with any element of this set generates a linear combination of everything within this finite set. And now hence the action of commutator H is basically reducing the problem from a n par l cross n par l problem to l cross l problem. There are exactly NL cross NL.
This is basically saying that they transform in the adjoint representation, right? You're saying that the commutator with the H is basically a linear combination of all the other generators.
Yeah, it does remind. It reminds even me of that, but I haven't been able to do anything with that analogy actually.
So is there like the solution? Do you have an algebraic solution after that, or do you have it computationally? I mean, in the general case.
We have an analytic solution for the creation annihilation operators, but this is the problem, we are not able to find the eigenstates, not even the ground state. And there is no notion of the ground state, because the notion of a ground state immediately means that I have a notion of lowest energy,
yeah,
whatever that means.
Yeah, just takes it back to the...
Yeah, and more importantly, the spectrum is complex. The energies look like this. For the transverse field Ising chain, it is basically plus or minus epsilon 1, plus or minus epsilon 2, until plus or minus epsilon
L. That is very self-consistent because you're looking at non-Hermitian Hamiltonians to begin with, so your system is unbounded. So there just is no lowest energy state.
Yes.
Any excitation actually can like bring it to a lower energy state. That's kind of the whole deal with unbounded.
I mean, if you plot the energies, you realize that these energies fall neatly into a regular polygon in the complex plane with the center at zero. And one of the vertices at unity, one.
But doesn't that just mean nth root of unity?
Yeah. It's basically the nth root of unity. It forms a neat regular.
Said, right? Sigma tau is proportional to tau up to some rotation.
Sigma tau is proportional to tau sigma. That's
tau sigma. Yeah, I mean they commute up to
One minus omega. The problem is this. The significant problem I am facing in my project is simply the absence of any expression for the eigenstates of any form. All we know are the eigen energies, and that is why in my project I have more or less given up on dealing with the eigenstates all over itself. And this is why, you know, I've been thinking of commutator H of an operator as a super operator H acting on the space of operators, and then deal with the super operator directly. This is in fact a very broad thing that can be done with, you know, I don't know, any arbitrary Hamiltonian. If I find the Hamiltonian too complicated in some way, commutator H, commutator of the Hamiltonian with an arbitrary operator, can be thought of as a super operator acting on the set of all operators. And naively, this is a much bigger operator. This is a much bigger operator than the Hamiltonian itself. But sometimes this can simplify. And the important point is this. Now look at the creation annihilation relation, commutator of H with A, let us say, it is something proportional to A. But in this language, if I write it down, A becomes like the eigen operator of commutator H.
So H, A, the commutator is proportional to A.
That is your usual creation.
Yeah, that's your usual algebra too, right? Yeah.
But now rewrite it in this formalism. It will become super operator acting on A gives me something times A. So this is now an eigen operator of super operator H. And the conserved charges are even better. The conserved charges are simply zero modes. The conserved charges simply, for example, H, J is equal to zero.
And this super operator acting upon J, that is 0. And it becomes part of the null space of super operator H. I think this is a nice way of looking at this.
I was thinking about the obvious analogous problem in, you know, usual classical mechanics, like a damped harmonic oscillator or something. You know, something where there is a decay involved. That's what complex energy eigenvalues mean in some sense. And let's say you know the Lagrangian, you know the energies. Can you construct the wave solutions given these? That's basically what you're trying to do, right?
Won't these waves decay off? I mean, if there are complex,
they decay off. No, but what I'm saying in classical mechanics, it looks like you can construct a solution for the
also,
wave.
I have
function.
A very weird question. What does ground state here even mean? Because the operator is unbounded, so
there is no notion of a ground state.
So what are you trying to find then?
I'm just trying to generalize this model to periodic boundary conditions. The open boundary
condition.
I thought
you were trying to find some energy state that some wave function that corresponds to these energies.
No, he gave up on that, is what he's saying.
I gave up on finding out the eigenstates.
So, but why is that even a problem? Because that should not be finding the ground state should not even be valid problem, because it's just an unbounded.
No, yeah, no. So he's operator. Saying that there is no ground state. The ground state just does not exist.
Right.
There's no meaningful way of.
Yeah, it's not a meaningful question.
No, so I think, so were you trying to come up with some kind of spectrum?
He
said there is no ground state.
Yes.
And so,
I mean,
what spectrum are you looking at?
I know the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. I don't know the eigenstates. I know the eigenvalues precisely, exactly, analytically, in fact. I know the eigenvalues very properly. I do not know anything about the eigenstates. I mean, of course, we can do things perturbatively, but no, that's not there. But on the other hand, everything goes straight to hell in the periodic boundary condition case, and that's what I'm trying to look at. Also, with regarding to what Amartya said right now, with in general complex analysis,
I was actually having this idea the other day. Suppose there is a Hamiltonian and it has all energies in the upper half of the complex plane or the lower half. Like, either way, there is eigenvalues are not on both sides of the real axis. They are on only one side. Now what I can do is, I don't know.
What? I do not.
No, suppose I know the spectrum of the Hamiltonian.
So the real part is either, complex part is.
No, but you can
all
also
of
shift
one
the
side.
Hamiltonian. I don't understand. You can shift the Hamiltonian by some additive constant. So if there is something on both sides, everything goes to either one axis or the other.
No, don't do that. That's exactly what I'm saying. Unbounded problems. You can do that, I guess. But you see, this is the idea. Suppose that all the imaginary eigenvalues have the imaginary part has of only one sign. What I can probably do is take these states.
Okay.
Time evolved them, and those states which have non-zero imaginary parts, they'll all decay off, and the only thing left will be the real part.
No, but then that's kind of stupid, because you're basically saying I have some complex number like x plus iy, and you're not, let's say y greater than 0.
Yes.
And now you're saying I'm not going to look at the case y less than 0. So now you're saying that there is a complex number z, but there is no z bar. So that means Z and Z bar.
That's something that I was thinking.
You've basically identified
Z
and Z bar. Yeah. You've basically identified Z and Z bar now. So it shouldn't be a surprise that you're on the real line.
Right.
I haven't identified Z and Z bar. All I'm saying is consider the case where all the eigenvalues are on one half of the complex plane.
That's what
it.
I'm saying. So it's x plus iy. You restrict y to y greater than 0. What is the Z bar for this Z? What is the complex conjugate for this Z? There is no complex conjugate because x minus iy would
is
lie
going
below.
To, yeah, but why should that be an eigen energy? It's not guaranteed that would be an eigen energy.
It's not
right?
Guaranteed, but generally, if you have a solution in complex numbers, I would expect a symmetry.
Yeah, because otherwise, the space of solutions isn't closed under addition, for example.
The space isn't closed under.
I mean,
addition.
if you have complex numbers, then you need other complex numbers to have a vector space.
Right. Or even a field structure.
Yeah.
Do the set of eigen energies for Hamiltonian have to have a closure property under addition?
No, but then the space that you're working on is has holes in it, right?
Yeah.
No, wait, this is a genuine question. Do the eigen energies of a Hamiltonian have to be closed under addition? Wait a minute.
I mean, if they're real numbers, they are. If they're complex numbers, they are. If they're
so, in the case of non-Hermitian, I am not very sure. But then, you call it physicist intuition or anything, but I would expect a symmetry between.
That is true.
No, what I'm saying is basically restricting only Z and then no Z star will restrict you to a subspace of the complex numbers, which is the real numbers, and that is what you say you're getting. And I'm saying that shouldn't be a surprise, because now the only if
you it's a half-baked idea, never mind.
And also, should the eigenvalues be closed under addition? Do the energy eigenvalues form a group under addition? I mean,
I thought the eigenstates did sort of so, because we can form a linear combination.
Yeah, it exactly. It's a vector space. It's a Hilbert space.
No, the eigen, the Hilberts, the vectors obviously are closed under addition or linear combination.
But then if the vectors are, then you should expect the eigen.
Yeah, because the space of your energies, your eigenvalues, uh-huh, is in 1-to-1 correspondence, or okay, maybe many to one correspondence, okay, with your eigenstates. But the group structure will still follow through, right?
Also, like the simple mathematical property, but the Hilbert space should also, since it's a vector space, there should be some field, underlying field for that vector space. Mm-hmm. And if there is a field structure, then you can't have this like adha dhura holes,
yeah,
in the field.
Yeah.
The oh
field,
yeah, that's
the field,
yeah, that's
itself should have a
field should have well defined addition,
yeah,
and multiplication.
But then this complex number thing.
No, but I'm still not convinced about this thing. Okay, suppose let us say we have a non-degenerate case. There is some energy eigenstate psi with eigenvalue e and phi with eigenvalue e dash. Now, is it necessary that I have another eigenstate with energy e plus e dash?
Why not? If you have psi plus psi dash.
Yeah.
Psi plus psi dash is not even an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian.
Why not? If psi and psi dash are normalized solutions,
yeah,
then psi plus psi dash by definition has to...
Wait. H psi plus psi dash? Wait.
We will do this slowly. Do you want me to bring a board? H psi is e psi.
Okay.
H psi dash is
e dash psi dash.
H psi plus psi dash is H psi plus H psi dash by the associative, no, what's it called?
Distributive
property.
Okay, so that is E psi plus
E
dash psi dash. It is not.
It's E psi plus E,
yeah,
dash psi dash.
It is not.
Okay.
It is not closed.
Okay. Oh,
that's the whole point.
We are dumb, sorry.
We are
dumb.
Stupid.
We are stupid. Kill me. Okay.
No, but see, Santosh has confused us over first year quantum mechanics somehow. But see, let's see.
If
the H is still an eigen, whatever, if this psi plus psi dash is an eigen state, then by definition we should have H something should be equal to
psi
E times something.
No, no. So the thing is, I think Chetan's point is this: if the spectrum is continuous, then
I'll give you a simpler example. Think about a simpler. Take particle in a box.
Okay, great.
Consider psi and first and second states.
Okay, great.
Then the linear combination is not an eigenstate. Simple thing.
That's what my point is.
Right.
So I'm saying the set of eigen energies is not closed under addition.
No, but I don't understand your point about the set of eigen energies, because for one, the eigen energies are numbers, some kind of.
Okay.
Whatever,
yeah,
field your thing is defined on, complex numbers, real,
okay,
numbers, something like that. So talking about closure for them is just a statement about closure for your field, underlying field. It's not related to.
But these are not all possible numbers. Take a specific Hamiltonian, take
right,
its eigen energies.
Uh-huh.
Now, if I take a linear combination of these eigen energies, why will they have to be another eigen energy for the Hamiltonian?
We are getting confused about the terminology closed. So closed in, when we say closed, we mean it in a, what do you call it, algebraic sense. Ki if you have two complex numbers,
mm-hmm,
then
yeah,
the sum of these two is another complex number.
Yeah.
But what you are talking about closure, yeah, is some kind of the fact that if you have two eigenvalues,
yeah,
the sum of eigenvalues is another eigenvalue.
Yeah. That is, yeah. That
that's
saying
not
sum of two complex numbers should be a complex number.
Oh, that is fine.
You are saying sum of two eigenvalues should be an eigenvalue.
No, I am not saying that.
So that's what it seemed from this conversation at least. But our point was that if your system, if your underlying field is closed,
mm-hmm,
then you can't have I would not expect the system to have the property that you can restrict all eigenvalues to only one half of the complex plane.
Okay, no, that is an ad hoc idea, just ignore it. That was something I was half baked, it's never mind.
Oh, so but then this complex plane.
No, I was thinking of a way to, okay, suppose there are, you know, plane wave solutions and there are evanescent solutions. I would still consider as something that decays off quickly.
Call it a decay. What the fuck is an evanescent solution? Evanescent is a band.
Yeah.
No, I would say that the dangerous problems are not the evanescent ones, but actually the ones that exponentially grow at any given time.
How can a solution exponentially grow?
Yeah, it's not normalizable if it grows.
But evanescent solutions are, I mean.
Because they decay.
Because if they decay, because the integral converges.
Arey, that's exactly what I'm saying. So if I want to allow only evanescent solutions and oscillatory ones,
mm-hmm.
but not exponentially growing ones,
mm-hmm.
the only possibility I have is, suppose, let us say e power ikx. Now k is either real, in which case it is just a normal oscillatory wave,
mm-hmm.
or it is confined to one half of the one side of the real
okay,
axis.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
No.
That's the idea. All I have to do, I don't have to restrict the system to real energy eigenvalues. I just have to restrict it to either real ones or decaying ones.
Isn't this like
ones.
A question about boundary conditions? Like, can't you close the contour in the lower half then, instead of the upper half? If k is, let's say, you know, plus I epsilon,
mm-hmm.
then you have e to the minus kx, minus
mm-hmm.
e to the epsilon kx or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you can close it, you know, above and it'll like converge. The other case, you can close it below. You're dealing in a complex plane. You can close the contour wherever you like.
There should be, even if you talk about this plane wave solution, there should be some symmetry between E and minus E. So even
yeah.
if you consider regular plane wave solutions, you know that if I e to the power ikx is a solution, e to the minus ikx is also an equally valid solution. So I don't see, like even if you're talking about the fact that in evanescent solutions, I should take E to be positive or negative or whatever, and it will be a decaying solution. I'm saying there should be some other solution in a linear combination with this, for which an equally valid solution is taking the complex number.
So basically saying for every decaying solution, there is a growing solution. In
I'm
a
not
intuitive.
Saying growing, I'm saying that for the other kind of solution, the positive eigenvalue, the positive complex numbers are the decaying solution.
Yeah.
I believe like, that's what my simple intuition would be, but I don't know about your system, so.
No, I'm not talking about my system. This is just a general thing. This has nothing to do with my system.
No, the point is this. You have some operator. It has some real, it has some complex eigenvalue lambda.
Mm-hmm.
Does it also have an eigenvalue lambda star? That is the question, right?
Yeah.
When you put it that way, it doesn't seem too restrictive.
But see, that's the
yeah,
problem.
But I get
usually
it. Yeah.
Quantum mechanics,
yeah.
we are restricted to...
Yeah.
Hermitian.
Yeah, no
way. Actually, a weaker condition of hermeticity is simply saying that the energy eigenvalues come in complex conjugate pairs.
That's just, yeah.
That's a weaker condition, but.
No wait. Oh, I don't like this.
But okay, if we forget about Santosh's system, since we seem to be getting nowhere.
Yeah, I don't understand. I've just gone into some kind of. Existential crisis about my understanding of quantum mechanics and complex numbers.
First year quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
No, this is the same idea I was thinking about. Usually in quantum mechanics, we usually say that I can consider arbitrary linear combinations of vectors in the Hilbert space, and the coefficients of these linear combinations usually form a field. Usually that field is taken to be the complex numbers, but suppose I restrict it to something else,
mm-hmm.
a certain subset. Of the complex numbers, can I come up with something interesting there? I don't know.
No, the point is this, you cannot restrict to this subset because of the following. Let's say you have some complex number x plus 0i.
Mm-hmm.
You have some complex number x plus iy,
okay.
where y greater than 0.
Okay.
Now by closure, x plus iy plus, there should be an element in the group x, which adds with x plus iy and gives you x plus 0i.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means to be closed. You cannot find such an element with your half-closed complex number.
No, forget the half-closed thing. All I'm saying is there something... There'll be sub-fields of the complex number field, right?
Which is called real number.
Yeah.
No, apart from that.
So
apart from the real numbers.
You can go rational numbers or something.
Yeah.
But that would be some periodic space. I don't see
yeah.
why that would be useful.
Apart from the real numbers, are there nothing useful? I'm
it's
not sure.
Periodic.
No, see, I think the fact that it's terribly unclear what happens if you restrict your eigenvalues to just one half of the complex plane,
mm-hmm.
the fact that we cannot come to a consensus is promising because it means you have something to think about and do. Yeah, so I think it's a good thing. But yeah, we practically bullied Santosh into saying some like starting off this episode by saying something, and now I like low-key regret it because now I feel dumb because I did not understand anything.
I don't either.
Yeah,
the system
good.
Is just horrible and it bullies
good.
Me.
It says something about you studying that system.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's talk about something I understand. Let's talk about There's this proposal. Okay, so it's gonna sound very fancy. It's called the emergence proposal. And the proposal is the following. It says that all kinetic terms for a quantum field theory in the IR
mm-hmm.
are generated by integrating out some heavy states in the UV.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from a renormalization group approach, this seems very believable because we know that integrating out heavy states like produces a running of the kinetic term.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you just sort of fix your renormalization conditions to be such that the kinetic term vanishes at some scale,
mm-hmm.
then it's entirely this integrating out procedure that's generating the running from mm-hmm. that zero kinetic energy. And so the emergence proposal is basically this, that all kinetic terms in the IR are generated by some UV states being integrated out. And there's a lot of very interesting applications of this. For example, if you look at something called the fermion condensate model, you know, Jorkin and Rell did a lot of work in it back in the day. So you have something like psi bar gamma mu psi whole squared.
Mm-hmm.
So an operator like this, an effective operator like this, it can be generated by integrating out some gauge field, for example. Or you can consider the following Lagrangian. You have some Dirac action,
mm-hmm.
right? And you introduce a background gauge field, a background a mu.
Okay.
So your interaction term looks something like psi bar gamma mu a mu psi, right?
With J mu a mu, basically.
Yeah, basically J mu a mu, with, I mean, or a covariant derivative, that's
okay.
what I'm saying.
Correct.
But there is no kinetic term for a mu.
Okay.
Now if you integrate out these fermions, what you get is actually a kinetic term for a mu, and the IR theory is like a theory of these vector bosons.
Okay.
And a lot of interesting things happen here because as it turns out, the sign of this, the sign of the interaction you put there
mm-hmm.
In your IR is very sensitive to the sign of the UV like coupling because you see, when you're generating out kinetic terms, you have to be very careful that they come up with the right sign.
Yes.
Right? So you have to. So you see, they have some kind of a positivity bound kind of an argument here, and a very interesting thing about this is very well studied. One problem people have always tried to understand is how do you break Lorentz invariance with spinners? Like one way to break, you know, so you know that a scalar field can acquire a vacuum expectation
yes.
value, but a spinner or a gauge field, any field with a spin cannot acquire, because then you've basically singled out a spin
mm-hmm.
and that singled out a direction, and so you've violated Lorentz invariance. But you can actually give vacuum expectation value to these condensates. So for example, you cannot give a vacuum expectation value to psi, but you can give a VEV to psi bar psi or psi bar gamma mu psi whole squared, something
mm-hmm.
like that. So you can give VEVs to these scalars. And studying the effective field theory of spontaneous Lorentz breaking, you know, system like this, where these operators acquire VEVs, has been, I mean, a lot of work has been done on this. But that's not what I want to talk about. The interesting thing is this emergence proposal actually very neatly connects with all your other Swampland conjectures. See, this has nothing to do with the Swampland conjectures on the first side. This is just saying some IR kinetic terms are generated by integrating out. They don't put any constraints on, you know, masses and charges and so mm-hmm. things like that. But actually, they do, because you can show that the emergence proposal is directly related to something called the magnetic weak gravity conjecture and the electric. I'll tell you what these are, and also something called as the species scale. So in the Swampland, you know, literature, there's this thing called the species scale, which basically says this. Let's say you have some cutoff scale for effective field theories, and below that cutoff, you have some n states in your theory, then basically this cutoff is, you know, has an upper bound which is something m Planck by root n or something.
Wait, the cutoff has an upper bound.
Distance conjecture.
Yeah, I mean, no, the distance conjecture is different. The distance conjecture is the following. It's actually very interesting. Okay, so the ultimate goal here is to show that all these conjectures are equivalent. Right, so obviously you can show that the species conjecture is somehow related to the distance conjecture, but the distance conjecture says this. Let's say you have a moduli space of some theories characterized
mm-hmm.
by VEVs of some some scalar field.
Mm-hmm.
It then says that you have a notion of a metric on this field space, and the first distance conjecture is that there exist two points on your moduli space such that this geodesic distance between them is infinite, and the second distance conjecture says that given two points in your moduli space, the distance between them is actually bounded by some exponential function, some exponentially decaying function. Like there's a bound on it. So these are your distance conjectures. They basically, and they're very stringy. People don't really talk about distance conjectures because it's difficult to get intuition from IR physics. right? Because there's no couplings, there's no suppression, there's no nothing. It's just a moduli space of theories and some arbitrary metric you have defined between these field spaces and the distance between these field spaces and some exponentially decaying thing. But this was motivated by string theory, like all conjectures are. But that's the distance conjecture. The species scale, it's not a conjecture, it's just a scale. Basically, it says that the cutoff of your theory is bounded by the species scale, which is like lambda by root n, where lambda is your...
What is n?
N is the number of species you have below that EFT cutoff.
Right.
Lambda S is some characteristic scale called the species scale. It's usually M Planck or something.
Okay.
And it's bounded by M Planck by root N. That's one conjecture. Then you have the weak gravity conjectures, which come in two forms. One is called the electric weak gravity conjecture, which basically says that there is some kind of bound on the charge to mass ratios. Its weakest form, the thing is, weak gravity conjecture, almost every version of it has been refuted by some of the other counterexample. So now people only talk about the weak gravity conjecture in its mildest form, in its weakest form, and it's actually quite useless there. And the form is that there exists a state of Q and a state of M where Q by M is bounded. So it's a very stupid statement at this stage. But that's because a lot of people have found a lot of counterexamples for the stronger statements. But then there's also magnetic weak gravity conjecture, which is inherently very weak, so there are not a lot of counterexamples for it. It basically says that if you have, let's say, some coupling G in your theory, you know, like, let's say simple, minus 1 by 4 G squared, F squared, or whatever, you know, some Yang-Mills kind of thing, then this G actually is, you know, suppressed by some M Planck times root something. Okay, so the mass of, there exists a mass, there exists a state which has a mass which is bounded by G times the max, the M Planck in that dimension. So this is the weak, this is the magnetic weak gravity conjecture.
Right.
And it turns out all of these are actually derivable from this emergence proposal.
I don't see any magnetism anywhere in this.
Yeah, see, I don't really know where the name comes about. So, yeah, I don't know. So, no, I know where it comes about from, obviously, because the weak gravity conjecture was, you know, primarily motivated by studying these RN, Reister, Nostrom black holes. Basically, extremal black holes, because that's where you find states that actually sort of saturate the Q by M bound. So, if there's any violations there, or if you really want to test your conjecture, that's where you're going to test it. So, I mean, that's where it comes from, the, you know, the magnetic charge of the black hole and the electric charge of the black hole and so on.
Right.
Because this G here is something like the magnetic charge of your black hole. But that's not too important here, because this holds in any generic effective field theory. Now, the thing is, if you look at this emergence proposal and you actually sit down and do some loop calculations, you say that, okay, some kinetic term is generated by some loop integral, like some loop being integrated out in the UV. Then a general, like the way these calculations work out is that you have some coupling in the IR, which is equal to some coupling in the UV, plus some log running kind of thing, if it's like a marginal operator that you're talking about. So like some log, you know, Q by M or something, lambda squared by MP or something, MP squared. And now the thing is, this emergence proposal amounts to setting your UV coupling to zero. That's your renormalization condition, basically, and you're free to specify it.
Okay.
You say that my coupling is zero at that scale, at the species scale in the UV. And from here, you see directly that now this log lambda squared by M squared something, you can bound it by, you know, some lambda or something.
Mm.
And you see this directly says that this coupling is bounded by, you know, G lambda, like M is bounded by G lambda or something. And so just the fact that this emergence proposal relies on you picking special renormalization conditions leads to all of these Swampland conjectures right away, which I think is very beautiful, because if someone just told me the emergence proposal, it wouldn't seem like a profound thing at all. I mean, anybody who has integrated out any field in his life knows that kinetic terms run.
Yes.
And to relate this to actual constraints on the couplings in the IR is very non-trivial. And when you're talking about these things, you aren't really talking about unitarity or whatever, all of these sacred principles. This is just regular perturbation theory.
Right.
Some weakly coupled UV theory, you integrate out shit, and then you fix some renormalization conditions, and lo, you have some weak. Now, the important, where this emergence proposal enters is, of course, in your renormalization conditions. This coupling is equal to UV coupling plus some log running is a generic feature. The emergence proposal enters by forcing you to pick special renormalization conditions,
right,
which make this weak gravity conjecture more transparent. Now the weak gravity conjecture also, by the way, when you say something like, you know, M is less than, you know, G something, how do I say this? It's a very simple-minded kind of thing. In general, you have this. If you actually look at the details of this derivation, you assume a lot of things. You assume that the scalar fields there are like dilatons, like they have no potential and things like that. And the only function they serve is like to pick out some field in your modular, like some configuration in your modular space. The only function they serve is to like parameterize a modular space, basically. And the thing is, if you actually generalize this to, you know, more arbitrary potentials. And let's say you have a coupling of the form, let's say you have some fields Ti, okay, some scalar fields Ti, and the scalar fields Ti have some vevs that characterize your moduli space, and now let's say you have some couplings of Ti, you know, one power of Ti with some other arbitrary fields, right? So now let's say you have some other, let's say, gauge field in your system, let's say AMU, AMU or something. Let's say you have a coupling like Ti, AMU, AMU.
Wait, AMU,
I mean, okay, it's not a gauge field, some vector field. Yeah. I'm just talking about vector field. So you have some AMU, AMU, and you have some Ti here. Now you see that if Ti acquired a expectation value, then this is actually like the mass term. So this is a mass term for your AMU. So in context like this, it becomes very difficult to say what mass you're talking about. Have you acquired a VEV? What is going on? And actually, the right way to modify your weak gravity conjecture is to treat these masses as basically, how do I put it? They're basically like forces in your moduli space. So it's like partial M by partial. So you have, okay, this is why I gave an example. Let's say you have T, AMU, AMU.
Mm-hmm.
What is partial by partial T of this thing? This is AMU, AMU. So now in some sense, all of these masses are just like these coefficients of some partial derivatives in a Taylor expansion.
Strange interruption.
Yeah, no, I had paused it. Some poor lad wanted to smoke, but we said, no, we have marked our territory. But yeah, I don't know why I rambled for so long.
You should
have
probably taken smokes from
him. Yeah. Anyway. But I don't know why I rambled about it for so long, but the emergence proposal is
you
basically...
You were talking about something, how you can... you have to modify the weak gravity.
Yeah. So basically, you modify the weak gravity conjecture by treating this mass as, you know, some derivative of these potentials.
Right.
Like, so partial V by partial Ti, basically.
Hmm.
Right? So now these are additional masses in a system and you must account for them in your weak gravity conjecture.
Right.
So now you basically just, it's M plus partial Ti, blah, partial Ti, blah, 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 is greater than your coupling or whatever.
I always felt that the weak gravity conjecture, like the, at least that might be the weaker statement of the weak gravity conjecture, but that was supposed to be for the couplings and not the masses. Because like at least what Lubos model describes it to be is that it's if you have any theory of any gauge theory that consistently couples to gravity in the UV, then the gravity has to be the weakest force. So it's something like the coupling, at least at some scale.
No, that's right. But the thing is here, the coupling is basically M Planck, right? 1 by M Planck. That's the coupling to gravity, right? In some sense,
right? Yeah.
G in some units is 1 by M Planck. So whenever you write things like G by M is less than 1 or greater than 1 or whatever, there's always M Planck hidden
right,
there.
Yeah, of course.
This M is just sort of there for, how do I say, dimensionality
I
reasons or something. So the M Planck is there and it's important. And this is why the weak gravity conjecture in different dimensions takes different forms.
I think it's violated in lower dimensions or something.
Yeah, probably. Right. In lower dimensions, a lot of things are violated. Cosmic censorship is also violated. Yeah, so lower dimensional, but that's because in lower dimensions you don't have a notion of general relativity as being your theory of gravity. So what you're looking at here is you're trying to, the way this works is the following. You have some QFT in flat space, right? Now this QFT in flat space is, you know, non-renormalizable, but it's perturbatively renormalizable up to some scale and blah blah blah. And now the question is, okay, I'm going to couple this to gravity. And then I'm going to see, will the cutoff for the CFT remain the same? That's the broad question. You have some cutoff here without gravity. What happens if you include gravity? Now will the cutoff change or not? If it could happen that it basically the cutoff, and you generically assume that the new cutoff will only come at M Planck. But it could happen that, you know, there are, you know, it's possible that when you couple it to gravity, your actual like cutoff scale becomes much smaller.
Right.
And so the theories with this in this region of your space are now in the swamp plant. it could happen that it goes up. A lot of things can happen. So, in fact, let me tell you something very interesting. I'm glad you brought this up. Speaking of cutoffs. So, we know that whenever gravitons are involved in the IR theory, then these IR amplitudes aren't well defined in the forward limit, right? Because you have a graviton exchange pole. You have an S squared by T kind of pole. And this diverges in the forward limit, it violates the Froissart bound and so on. So you cannot derive any low energy. So all of these positivity bounds and all of these things are basically consistency criteria between IR and their UV completions.
Right.
And so in the presence of this pole, you cannot establish any consistency criteria because this is negative and it blows up. Now, the thing is, one way to control this forward pole, and we've talked about this, I think, at some point, is to actually compactify your theory and look at compactified amplitudes.
Right.
And compactifying this theory basically makes the graviton non-propagating in that dimension. Now, this is not exactly true. The S squared by T pole still shows up. It's just that it gets resummed away by something that's called an Iconal thing. It basically, you keep adding all higher order ladder diagrams. So, like, you have some loop, then you keep adding them up. And this is called an Iconal summation, and then this basically cancels out. On resumming everything, this cancels out. But the point is, this is one way to control the forward pole. But the thing is, this is actually inconsistent for a lot of theories. This procedure is inconsistent for a lot of theories, and it turns out that there's a very deep reason for this. This was work done by Adiram and these people recently, I think last year. And the point is, in three dimensions, scattering amplitudes aren't very well defined. And that's for a very beautiful reason. It's because, you know, these scattering amplitudes, when you write your S matrix as something like 1 plus IT, you assume that there is a 1 there. You assume that there is some probability of, you know, like a trivial interaction, like no scattering happening, just like things going and going through. You assume that there is a 1. You assume that there is this split 1 plus IT, and then you do S dagger S is equal to something, and then you derive the optical theorem. But in three dimensions, this 1, does not exist. There is no... that's because graviton being non-dynamical, it basically has a non-local kind of an interaction. So you can its influence is still felt like arbitrarily large.
Right.
So in technical language, there's a conical deficit angle and so on in your scattering amplitudes. And so basically this 1 plus IT split you cannot do. You'll always be haunted by some, you know, unnecessary delta functions to compensate whenever you have this 1 plus IT kind of split. And more interestingly, the unitarity, if you insist on writing, you know, compensating this delta function and everything, and you insist on writing a 1 plus IT kind of form, the unitarity condition is not S dagger S equal to 1, but it's S dagger S equal to minus 1.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So in three dimensions, the important point is this. You can either have a scattering matrix that respects the analytic structure of your theory, but not the conventional form of the positivity, of the unitarity, of like the optical theorem. So, like, you can have something that respects the analytical structure, the pole structure, but it will not have the condition that the imaginary part must be positive for that amplitude. So, it's a trade-off. You can either get rid of this and lose that, or keep that and lose this. It's easier to just keep the pole structure there and lose the imaginary part positivity, like,
right,
for practical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, this compactification procedure is tricky because in three dimensions, S matrices are very difficult to define. And that's just basically because there is no trivial scattering in three dimensions.
Okay.
And now the thing is, if you insist on saying that positivity bounds, this IR UV consistency thing, should be, you know, something that's invariant under dimensional reduction. So if I enforce this in 3, it should be there in 4. If you insist upon this, then you see that your theory falls into the swampland much quicker. You would naively expect that you can call it the magnetic weak gravity conjecture, or you could call it common sense. But you would expect that the cutoff scale for your theory, for new physics to emerge, would be M Planck. Once you've coupled it to gravity. But you find out that if you have, you know, some generic mass scale in your system, call it M, then the cutoff scale reduces to root M times M Planck. And M is obviously much lower than M Planck. So this is much lower than M Planck. So it basically says that if you want to enforce these IR UV consistency criteria in four dimensions by taking lessons from three dimensions, you must introduce new physics at a parametrically lower scale than what common sense tells you to. So basically, the swampland begins very quickly.
Right.
And this is very interesting. Because it seems like a cute proposal, right? I mean, compactify theory, pole goes away, make positivity bounds, continue to four dimensions. But in three dimensions, the scattering amplitudes are very weirdly defined. There was a lot of confusion about this. In fact, last year, I was thinking about this at around the same time that these papers came out. But the original paper, some ways to work this out was basically the fact that, so when you continue from compactified results to, you know, non-compactified results, the formal prescription is to take the limit L goes to infinity.
Right.
You're not stupid. You don't compute something entirely in a compactified theory and then say the same thing holds in four-dimensional theory. You keep all your compactification radius and everything intact, and then you take that limit. And the other limit that you're supposed to take is the gravity decoupling limit, you know, M Planck goes to zero or whatever goes to zero. And for the longest time, people believe that M Planck goes to infinity and L goes to infinity. Maybe they just don't commute. Maybe these limits don't commute, and that's why there's this inconsistency. Because some people worked out some partial UV completions and they showed that this doesn't work. Now, since we are on the subject of graviton-forward poles, there is actually a way to control them, like a well-defined way to control them. And this was first conjectured by Dirac actually last year in a paper, that the thing is, this forward pole, the presence of this forward pole basically says that there is no positivity bound in the IR, but it's violated by some order one coefficient. That is yet to be determined. It depends on like some, basically, your UV theory. But instead of having a strict positivity, you have something like greater than some negative number. And this basically is very deeply tied to the fact that in flat space-time, positivity bounds are related to causal propagation of quantum fluctuations. So if you do a classical calculation like Niemann and these people did in 2007, they first showed that positivity bounds basically arise from demanding non-tachyonic modes in a flat space-time background. But the thing is, in gravitational backgrounds, this is very tricky because, one, there is no unique notion of velocities because you can do a diffeomorphism and everything changes. So you have to talk about some ratios and all of that, some speed of sound ratio to something and all of that. And the thing is, curved spacetimes actually allow a certain amount of negativity, which can still be resolved in the EFT paradox. Like, it cannot be resolved in... So basically, causality is violated when you can integrate over some causality violating effects up to a scale that is visible in your IR. You could have microscopic IR like causality violations, but if they're not like large enough for an IR observable to see, there is no IR inconsistency.
Right, it appears only in the UV.
Yeah.
Whatever.
But, and so in curved spaces, actually, these positivity bounds have nothing to do with causal structure. In fact, it's allowed to be a little negative. And this is a very beautiful result, and it's also something people knew long ago, because QED coupled to gravity, people have been studying for a really long time, and people realized then that you can actually have superluminal propagation without violating causality.
Right.
And then there's this business with, you know, front wave and, you know, and whatever, group velocity, phase velocity, front velocity, and all of these things. But that's a different story. But the thing is here, so these people said that there's some allowed, you know, negativity, some order one negativity. And one way this comes about very explicitly is by assuming some kind of a Regge behavior in the UV. So string theorists assume, like, basically you assume that there is an infinite tower of spins. So your theory, your four-dimensional theory, is like some compactified high-dimensional theory. So there's a Kaluza-Klein tower and there's a tower of high-dimensional spins. And so your amplitude has some kind of a Regge trajectory. It has a Regge behavior. So it's some weird function with some polynomials, JT and all of these, which depend on the spins of your higher states. And if you assume that this string theoretic Regge behavior is the true behavior in the UV. Now see, this is not a generic requirement. Until now, positivity bounds were derived assuming just unitarity and causality and everything. If you make the additional assumption that there is a Regge behavior, then you can tune these Regge polynomials to actually cancel out this S squared by T pole. And from there, you do actually obtain a bound, and it is exactly the one Dirac and these people conjectured. And it's basically saying with gravity there, what was a positivity bound in flat space becomes like a slightly negative thing. And this order one parameter is precisely given by, you know, the some coefficients of your Regge polynomial or whatever.
Right.
And
I think this is something like, this was also what Tushar and like he worked with Shiraz.
Yeah, they were talking. Yeah. It was a graviton four
right,
point
so
scattering matrix.
About, if you take any d-dimensional Einstein gravity, and basically if you talk about its EFT, then you have these various bounds, your positivity bound, and various things that can bound the coefficients or what terms can appear in your Lagrangian. And then I think they assumed a locality or. And this Regge behavior of your amplitude that in the UV. And what they realized was that the only terms that were possible were some extensions of the Einstein, whatever, GR. And that was precisely consistent with string theory, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's like an interesting connection, but
yeah. But then this reggae behavior is actually so Shiraz's paper with Tushar was on the 4-point function. Maldesena had an old paper, I think 2010 or something, constraining the graviton 3-point coupling. And there also they assumed that the only way to control that pole is through a reggae procedure.
Right.
And there also they did the same thing. Some reggae kind of behavior assumed in the UV, and they put constraints on the graviton 3-point coupling in the IR. But the thing is, with the take-home lesson is that the only consistent way known till date to control this forward pole is to assume a reggae behavior in the UV, which very strongly hints to the fact that string theory is the right UV completion.
Right.
Because, I mean, you need additional input to make this theory well-behaved. And this additional input is apparently the string theoretic one. This
I mean, it's obvious that string theory is a consistent theory of quantum gravity. And essentially, all these EFT, like these conjectures that we have, they, like, the general point about these is that these are kind of like bootstrap arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are the conditions that any necessary consistent theory of quantum gravity should have? And so, like, it sort of makes sense that string theory satisfies all these bounds.
Mm.
But the real thing that, like, I sometimes feel is that I felt that string theory should be much more, constraining than these EFT bounds. So every time you do these, like, all these papers that are, like, these positivity bound papers or any of the EFT conjectures that we have, anything that you can derive from EFT, any property that you expect any consistent theory of quantum gravity should have, if you derive a bound from those generic principles and then you derive the same thing from string theory, you realize that you get the same or very similar bounds.
No, so, obviously, but because the UV input is just very generic stuff, is unitarity, analyticity and everything.
Right, so that's from the EFT side. But like if you consider a string theory, then it's supposed to be like a consistent UV completion of any generic gauge theory that you have. So I would expect, like, if string theory really was a very powerful tool, you would expect the bounds from string theory to be much more stringent or something than generic bounds that you derive from EFT arguments.
No, but that's the point, right? That's the point. We are trying to move away from string theory. We are trying.
I completely agree with your program, because I feel like I'm not a very big fan of the string theory program. I think it's like a good program. String theory is a consistent theory of quantum gravity. It's just that the program is not very, it's not very useful. So of course you know that it can give you a consistent theory of quantum gravity, and eventually if you end up finding a theory of quantum gravity which is not a string theory, you can like the general idea is you can show that it's consistent with a string theory. So you can always find some string compactification that will give you that particular theory of quantum gravity, whatever that might be. But then that's the point, like your string theory is, like anything that you get from a string theory can more or less be derived from the CFT argument. So that's why I feel that string theory is a bit lacking there. So like it's been 50 years since people have been working on string theory. So that's kind of a bummer.
No, but that's the thing, right? The reason this Swampland program and everything started out was because this thing called, right, standing under the string lamppost.
Right.
People were looking for consistent theories with string theory, with just string theory, which is a very stringent requirement, and then there is no evidence that string theory is actually correct. So then you want to derive some kind of constraints in the IR, assuming the most generic possible UV behavior, you know, it's unitary and everything. And so you get these bounds, which are obviously weaker than what you would get from some specific UV completion. I mean, it's obvious, right? So you do some positivity bound argument, you see that, okay, for dimension 6 operators, this is negative or positive depending on scalar channel or vector channel. If you actually have a vector like UV completion, then you can actually compute the exact Wilson coefficient. So, I mean, it's kind of obvious that these EFT bounds are weaker than anything that you actually get when you've considered the UV completion. But the whole point of this program is to get out of this string theory.
But my point is that if string theory is it's a consistent theory of quantum gravity, like that we have known from 1970s.
Yeah.
So if string theory itself was such a, if it was a good theory, then it would have given you very stringent bounds, which was something people have been expecting since 1980s, but no one ever found these.
No, but the thing is, the stringent bounds string theory gives are not testable, right? That's the thing. The reason we don't accept string theory is, I think, I mean, at least I would say this as a phenomenologist. Okay, I'm not a phenomenologist, but that it gives no new predictions that are testable. any,
but still, if you consider, see, consider your positivity bound arguments, for example, this DRAM calculation that you were talking about, that you can have some order one term to your, that you can add to your three-point coupling or something. And you said that these DRAM and these people, they conjectured using some EFT arguments, and then Maldesin and some collaborators showed using string theory or these Rege bounds that you get similar or very close.
No, you got me wrong then. This DRAM conjecture was motivated by string theory. It wasn't from EFT. From EFT, you cannot do anything with gravitons. That's the thing. Unless you compactify, and then you see that there are inconsistencies.
I see. But, so I'll talk about a similar thing that I think recently people calculated last year, which was they tried to find, using these EFT arguments, they tried to find the bound on some certain operators. Say, let's call it an alpha, some kind of a coupling operator. In 10 dimensions, you considered some supersymmetric theory, and you tried to find out what are the coefficients that you, some Wilson coefficients for that particular operator that you can have. And they did it using some EFT argument, bootstrap arguments, essentially. And you computationally solved it, and you got some bound which is of the form 0.14 or something, or 0.139. And then you did the same computation in string theory, and you got a, like, if the bound there was like the bootstrap gave you 0.14, then string theory gave you 0.139. So it's like a close agreement, and sort of it gives you the fact that so if you showed using the EFT arguments, what are the possible like what's the parameter space this alpha values can have, you found that string theory exactly agrees with all of that. But that's the thing, that string theory itself, it's like, if it's a consistent theory, if it's a good model, it should give you very stringent bounds, but it's giving you more or less the same bounds that you're getting from EFTs. Generic EFT proposals. So that's why I do not like the, like, I think string theorists need to work more on their models. That's my point. Of course, they are trying the swarm plant program, but that's, I believe that's more or less same as the EFT program.
It's the same as the EFT. In fact, the swarm plant program began by looking for consistent embeddings into string theory, but now it's just consistent embeddings into anything that is unitary, causal, and blah, 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 and all of that. And, I mean, there's obviously many interesting things. Okay, what if there is a dark sector in the standard model that, you know, is actually non-unitary, but because it's a dark sector, we have not observed this unitarity violation. And you can speak of things like this, but, I mean, okay, as long as you can't see it, how do you say what, how do you know if what you're making is sense? I mean, the neutrino was supposed to be like one of the dark sector particles, right? Until it, it's just that it's cosmologically abundant, so you can actually, there is some hope of seeing it. It could be possible that there is some dark sector particle that is non-unitary. It is part of your full UV theory. You'll just never see it in your experiments, and you'll conclude that your theory is unitary.
That's sort of why I do not like particle phenomenology as a field, because their entire theme these days is of the form that consider some particle in standard model that's kind of exotic. For example, neutrino or right-handed neutrino or Higgs. And consider some open problem like dark matter. And
make it a dark matter candidate.
Yeah, right. So you give it some sort of a twist to connect it to dark matter. Either it's,
I think
it talks
too many dark matter candidates.
Yeah.
There are a lot. Like, everything can be a dark matter candidate. That's the point.
Yeah.
And it will give you something in the parameter space. But that's the thing. You are not able to restrict that parameter space.
No, but that's where these positivity bound arguments come into play, right? So, for example, people ruled out massive Galilean theories as dark matter candidates because of positivity bounds, because there was this theory of the massive Galilean that could be a potential dark matter candidate, and from the IR input, you could tune your parameter space to, you know, consistently match what the dark matter observations tell you. But the thing is, people realize it cannot be embedded in any unitary UV theory and all of that. So people ruled it out as a possible dark matter candidate.
One of my favorite models, I think, dark matter ones were, so there is a very famous model known as a weakly interacting massive particle, which is sort of ties to the neutrino story, how people believe that some kind of a neutrino should be a dark matter candidate. Generally, the idea is that you don't see a right-handed neutrino, and very simple CISO arguments give you the fact that you should expect a right-handed neutrino at the weak scale or the TeV scale, whatever, something related to that. And you can do some kind of a very back of the envelope calculation using some arguments about these dark matter, like generic things that you know about dark matter, to show that a weakly interacting particle with couplings in the TeV scale should generically be a dark matter candidate. Like, that could satisfy most of the what you believe about your dark matter, and that's why people believe that these neutrinos should somehow be responsible, or at least be talking to the this dark sector. But then there was another proposal, I think some 10-20 years back, which was I think it was a wordplay on this weakly interacting massive particles, but it was called the strongly interacting massive particle, or SIMP. But that was long before the word SIMP was used.
Annihilated right by now. TikTokers.
But the idea was that if you could consider a very strongly interacting particle with a very cool interaction, something like a Visumin-Witten kind of interaction, one of the very interesting interactions that you can have in the standard model, and that kind of a model would generically give you something that it gives you a very good dark matter candidate. But I think it has been ruled out by experiments, but still it was a very very interesting proposal. And another thing is that it has a Visumin-Witten interaction, so it seemed very cool to me. But it just seems that I think it sort of explained the fact that you don't see a lot of. So I think one of the ideas in the dark matter field is that dark matter is it's a problem in dark matter field. It's called the thermalization of dark matter.
Yeah.
So the idea is that we know that there was something like a Big Bang, which means that at some point in the very past, things were very hot and
when I was in school.
Okay. So that's the thing, things were close and hot and whatever, and then sort of this expansion phase started and everything cooled down. So the idea is that you could consider regular standard model particles, and you could see that since the standard model particles interact with each other, they could thermalize.
Yeah.
So they could essentially just bounce off each other and release the whatever the excess energy that they had as a form of heat, which you see in the CMB. But dark matter essentially does not have this. So it's dark, so it
does
cannot
not
release photons.
Yeah.
Right. So if there are dark matter particles that were produced along with the standard model particles during the Big Bang, then how would the dark matter thermalize?
Yeah.
That is a big problem.
Particles simply interact among each other?
Of course, they will interact among each other.
Yeah,
but how will it thermalize?
Yeah.
So if you want to thermalize, you have to release energy in the form of some boson, right?
Yeah.
If you just interact among each other, you will just keep on heating up. If you have gas particles and they just bounce off each other, won't they just keep on, won't that be a hot gas?
See, the thing is, with the standard model process, things, you have processes like baryogenesis and leptogenesis and whatever, where these elementary particles actually, combine, found bound states,
right,
and release the excess energy.
Right.
And this is how they thermalize.
Okay.
But dark matter does not have any such thing, the only interaction it has is like a gravitational interaction, which is like super, super weak, then how did it thermalize? Because CMB is uniform, more or less. How did they reach equilibrium or whatever?
Right. And so also if you consider the the most common model for cosmology, which is lambda CDM, it's supposed to be cold dark matter.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be hot dark matter.
Yeah.
Because hot dark matter generically, I think it's just ruled out.
Yeah.
Looking at the CMB data and everything.
Yeah.
Right.
So dark matter is supposed to cool down somehow.
Yeah, but how?
But that's you don't know because it's dark, so it does not interact with photons or anything. And so how can you cool down a dark matter? This is a big problem. I think it's one of the key to solving the dark matter puzzle.
Yeah.
But I think the idea in this... how will it cool down? Gravitational waves, that's very difficult.
Plus it's very weak.
It would be
very
inefficient. I don't think you would thermalize in the time scales. The time scales that you have.
There's very stringent bounds on these gravitational waves.
Right. Also, if you produce those kind of gravitational waves, you could easily see them on the CMB polarizations or something, if the dark matter was such a powerful gravitational interaction.
Which is why people now look at, some other exotic particle that could have existed, back then and given rise.
But that's why I like this strongly
interacting.
That's a Ponzi
scheme, postulating new particles.
No, but that's the thing.
Yeah.
So that's why phenomenology, I don't like that field at all. I tried that, it seemed something that would not never reach a consensus or anything. You could never make that work.
No, but the thing is, as long as you're making testable predictions, you are constraining whatever bullshit you're coming up with.
Yeah, that I completely agree.
Yeah.
But, that seems a very, how do you call it? you want to get some job done, but you are doing something very irrelevant to that, just because it has some indirect, like it will help doing that job, whatever.
Stop describing my project.
But okay, so the reason this strongly interacting proposal was very exciting was because it gave a very good explanation to how this thermalization could occur. And I think essentially the point is that this Wess-Zumerov-Witten interaction is like a, so it's kind of like a 5-point interaction. It's like 3 to 2 or 2 to 3, something like this interaction. And so for one, it will be a very, how do you call it? The probability of this occurring would be very low, which sort of explains why dark matter is dark, or like it does not interact a lot with the standard model particles. But whenever it does, because 5-point interactions are generically like very difficult to occur, because like it's
5 particles must come.
Chemistry argument. Yeah, 5 particles at single point is very difficult. So that's one reason why it would be like very like the interactions would be difficult to see, and that would give you like if you do the thermal analysis, if you calculate that, you could see that it would lead to thermalization in these scales. And so it was like a very cool problem, but then it did not pan out.
I remember reading about axions and how they are related to this thermalization.
Axions, I believe, should form, like, I think everyone, we sort of know that axions should form some kind of a dark matter.
Yeah, axion is like our best bet at solving the puzzle. But yeah, I don't remember the details. Maybe on the next podcast episode. You talked about the Wess-Zumerov-Witten term. And that's what reminded me about the A theorem, because it's this Wess-Zumerov term that basically captures the A anomaly, the A coefficient. It's basically the term that captures the anomalous part of your trace energy momentum tensor. And in fact, studying this term is extremely important, because in a way it allows you to bootstrap your energy momentum tensors, which is essentially saying you're bootstrapping your spectrum, you're bootstrapping your theory and so on. So studying the fucking hell, it's cold, I'm almost shivering, what the fuck. So the Wess-Zumerov-Witten term is essentially entirely the term that leads to the running of this degrees of freedom from the UV to the IR, and the fact that this flow is monotonous is equivalent to saying that this Wess-Zumerov-Witten term obeys like some kind of a dispersion relation. And this is the proof in 4 dimensions. In 6 dimensions, this proof doesn't hold. And it's for an interesting reason, but I'll maybe talk about it in the next episode, because I think this has become too long. And also dark sector particles, we wanted to talk about it. It's very interesting that dark sector, when you write down some, you know, effective action involving some dark sector particles, then it's not necessary that this cutoff scale for this dark sector is actually the EFT cutoff. It's actually usually much lower than the EFT cutoff, which is why you're going to never safely integrate them out in some sense, because the scale of this cutoff is actually just set by whatever integrating out happened in the UV and not your EFT theory. And since there's like the problem, you can have, for example, dark sector, you can have like dark states like Z mu, for example. You have some UV completion, Z mu, E bar, gamma mu, E. Now this Z mu is in principle like a dark particle, in the sense that you can only, you'll not be able to see it in EE to EE scattering. You won't be able to see ZZ to ZZ scattering or something like that at, like, you know, low order and, I mean, low at low energies. So it's very difficult to constrain its lifetimes and things like that. There are some stringent lifetimes on Z prime, actually. The fact that no Z prime decay was observed basically puts a very strong constraint on the coupling of this Z prime to E. And Z prime, as you know, is also a dark matter candidate.
Right. Yeah.
So, but yeah, let's not go there. It's related to a lot of things. It's related to we also wanted to talk about the muon G-2. I wanted to talk about G-2 because it turns out a lot of the effort to resolve this lattice versus experiment wala results is that whatever new physics you assume to solve the G-2 puzzle also solves the B physics anomalies and these things, baryon puzzles and these things.
But that's one thing that like sort of turns me off about phenomenology, because you can always find every two, like, and you can I can make it a theorem. You can always find two open problems in phenomenology, such that the solution to one gives you a very good solution to the other one.
Yeah.
It's always there.
Yeah.
Like, you can take axion and dark matter, you can take neutrino and dark matter, you can take neutrino and axion, you can take any two, you can take weak gravity conjecture and neutrino, you can take any two open problems, and you can always find one model that explains both of them very.
But you don't really blame them, right? Because
right,
what are
course.
The other people doing? What are string theorists doing?
Oh, I completely
yeah,
agree. I don't like string theory.
No,
so
the thing is, the interesting theoretical physics happens somewhere at the interface of phenomenology
right,
and
yeah.
string theory. And there's not a lot of people who do it. Like, if you open, like, HEP-THK listings, it's all just mathematics. And if you open HEP-PH, it's just collider physics. And maybe once a week, you'll find one paper that's, like, at the interface and it's interesting, you know. It deals with, you know, elegant formalism and gives you testable predictions.
Right.
But usually, it's just some very, like, disgusting calculation done or something.
No, but, like, there is one thing that I'll just give some idea, but not talk about it right now. It's something related to the fact that... So, it's called flat space holography. Very generically.
Yeah.
So the idea is inspired by ADS-CFT, but it's not ADS-CFT at all, and it has nothing to do with string theories. So the generic idea is that you can, so it's something of the form that gravitational theories are expected to be integrable in some sense. So the fact that you can calculate the entire gravity as matrix, like there is an idea that you can do that, but you, if you just look at gravitational theories per se, you don't see anything that even gives you a hint about this integrability. But there was some very old work in 1970s and 80s by some, I think, Bondi and some BMS, some people, who showed that this, like if you take any asymptotically flat space time or something, then at these asymptotic limits, the gravitational theories, they seem to have a very, like a very large symmetry. Some infinite dimensional symmetries that sort of described your gravitational theories.
But these are pure gravity theories, right?
Pure gravity theory.
Yeah,
the BMS argument was pure gravity.
Yeah, because you can't have any symmetry in
right.
quantum gravity.
But then the interesting thing was, like, it came in 2010 or 15 by Strominger, who realized that these infinite dimensional symmetries can actually be thought of as the real symmetries of gravitational matrix. So the idea is that Strominger gave a different argument. He took gauge theories, and he showed, so if you look at what's called as the gauge symmetry in a gauge theory, we know that this gauge symmetry is not a symmetry per se. It's thought of as a redundancy in the description. But what Strominger showed was that it's actually a symmetry. You
right.
can think of the gauge symmetry as a symmetry, but what is this symmetry? Like, kis cheez ka symmetry hai? So what he realized was that so the idea is that why do you actually need gauge symmetry? So the thing is, if when we write our Lagrangians, we usually write it in very redundant variables, and so it if you look at the scattering matrices, it will show problems there, because for one, if you have these like there will be some component that will have negative norms, and so that's
this was the typical problem with non-abelian gauge theories.
Right. Even your electromagnetic, even if you have a free gauge theory, it will have a negative norm state. But you know that this is a, like, this is bad, so it can be projected out. And then you will have some overcounting. So you will have some repeated modes and stuff like that. And then you know this is due to the gauge redundancy. And then you get rid of that also. And that gives you the real scattering matrix. But what is usually glossed over in regular formalisms of gauge theory is that there is another symmetry here. Like, there is what is known as a residual gauge symmetry. So you still have your, if you look at the two polarization states of your gauge theory, gauge boson, whatever, you still have a symmetry that you can mix these two. So this is a residual symmetry. But the thing, if you look at the S matrix level, it does not give you any problems there. So it's more or less like it doesn't, like your S matrix doesn't care about this residual gauge symmetry. And so it's fine. You don't get a problem there. But what you realize is, Strominger realized was that this residual gauge symmetry actually contributes. Like, say, this is an actual symmetry for if you take the asymptotic limit of your theory. So if you start studying your theory at infinity, like at some space like or time like infinities, what you realize was that this was an actual symmetry of the theory. And you could think of these gauge symmetries as being some sort of ordered entities for those symmetry. And so he formulated some kind of what is known as a IR triangle, which means that you can just study the, at far IR, for any kind of a theory, there is a relation between these three things, which is soft theorems, and another thing is your gauge symmetries and things, and the third one is called a memory effect. So what Strominger realized was that these, soft theorems, like, they generically tell you what is the IR behavior of your regular scattering matrices.
Mm.
So it kind of tells you that if you just take your one of your particles to have very low energy, there are certain like factorization conditions that just sort of like there are certain factorization conditions there. For example, in the case of like these Weinberg theorems, we talked about it last time.
Mm.
The point is that these soft theorems are connected to like they can be thought of as the Ward identities for some big infinite dimensional symmetry groups. And what he realized was that like taking both of them in conjunction was that there is actually a physical effect that you can measure, which is known as the so-called memory effect. So it's kind of like the fact that if you have some charge and there is an electromagnetic wave in front of that charge, then that charge will oscillate or something, and then when the wave goes away, then the charge will stop oscillating or something. But then is the like the after this interaction with the wave, is the charge the same or not? Like if will it be at the same position or not, something like that. So you can sort of show that it's not the same, like it's not at the same physical position as it was before it interacted with the wave. So it's kind of a continuation of this argument to gravitational case, that if you have some generic observer and there is a gravitational wave that passes through this observer, after interaction of the gravitational wave, there will be some kind of a, like the observer will not be at the same position as it was before interacting with the wave. And so there is a kind of a physical effect that you can measure here, which is known as the gravitational memory effect.
Mm.
And that sort of like it, if you could actually measure that, which like I think they have hopes that you could, then it will sort of give you an idea about the fact that so it will sort of give you a confirmation of this thing, that there is actually an infinite dimensional symmetry that underlies these gravitational theories. And the cool thing is that this infinite dimensional symmetry is like is kind of like a CFT. So you can think of a four-dimensional gravitational theory. The S matrix of this theory is given by the what are known as the conformal correlators for this CFT at the asymptotic limits. So you essentially have a 2D CFT which corresponds to the correlators of which corresponds to S matrix of your gravitational theory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this sounds weird because this should not be true, because there should be some kind of LSC procedure or something.
Mm.
But what they realized was that so the LSC procedure is that you have some correlator, and then there is a what is known as a LSZ reduction, some kind of an integral.
You put propagators on shell, and then
right.
they basically.
And when you do that procedure, it gives you the S matrix elements.
Yeah.
So the idea is that if you take the S matrix and you do this LSZ procedure, what this LSZ procedure corresponds to is some kind of generalized Fourier transform in that case. Which is known as a Mellin transform, whatever.
Mm.
Doesn't matter.
Mm.
But the point is that.
But isn't this for 2D CFTs?
Right. So it's a 4D theory that corresponds to a 2D CFT.
Oh.
That's why it's different from regular holography that
it's different from
sort of know, which is D plus 1 and D dimension. So this is strange. And then but the interesting thing is that the LSC procedure actually corresponds to taking some kind of Fourier transform. That's why correlators on one side is getting mapped to actual scattering amplitudes on the other side. So I think Strominger and his collaborators are working on this thing, like super interesting thing.
It is very interesting.
Which is kind of interesting because 2D CFTs are sort of exactly solvable in some sense. Like if you can solve something exactly, it's a 2D CFT. And then you have a gravitational S matrix that's sort of just in a one-to-one dictionary with this 2D CFT. I find this very interesting. But I guess this podcast has been very long now.
Yeah.
One thing that I was thinking about is recording an actual riff for the podcast intro and outro, rather than the
Oh, that'll be nice.
Something that we get from Anchor app.
Hmm.
But see, the problem there is I actually had an idea to like something that could serve as a riff, but problem is recording that because I have a very bad app, and I sort of don't know what to do with it. But that would be very interesting.
Also, do you guys want to call somebody on the podcast?
I think before that, we should find a way to do like a video podcast.
I would love to do a video podcast.
Yeah.
But again,
Science Media Center.
I mean, we can call someone, but if we, like, see,
then
calling someone makes sense if whatever that person is talking about is. Okay, I'll give you an example. If we call someone from, say, condensed matter, and that guy is doing, what do you call it? give me some exotic topic in condensed matter.
Everyone does topological condensed matter.
Okay, then yeah. I don't know topology or condensed matter, so I would just be zoned out throughout that conversation. You see my point. So it would be interesting if we could find someone whose work sort of relates to everyone. But that's like
or someone who can at least like phrase it in a way that's accessible to people who also
right.
do other things.
I think that is a problem in all of science these days. I mean, specialists, you see, even at our level, there is a certain disconnect between a condensed matter person and two high energy people.
See, I don't think there is a disconnect. I think it's like we should take the responsibilities ourselves. We are bad at communicating.
Yeah.
Because if you give the, like, I would say if you give me enough time, I could find, if you give all three of us enough time,
yeah.
we could find something that, we could easily explain to each other what our, yeah. each other's work is.
Like, if you actually,
give us a black board
we actually prepared for one of these things, then it would be different. But then it wouldn't be fun, so.
Right.
Yeah.
It's much more interesting to talk shit on the podcast and not do these whiteboard presentation kind of things. Because you can always get that in the
seminar.
The seminar room 31 or something.
Can we go get some tea?
Please.
Yes, it's
okay.
Quite windy and that would be the end of this podcast.
Yes. Okay. Let's... How the fuck do I... Okay.